Hi, I am an unplayable 5-mana sorcery that gains and drains. Kira.
Hi, I'm a 0-mana Manorok that can't tap till turn 4. Maya.
And I'm a 7-mana creature with a high Q in the text box. Ben.
There's someone else in the room with us.
What the hell?
Oh my goodness. Don't worry. This is intentional. Today in the studio with us, we have none other than legendary Magic the Gathering Australian player, Ben Tudman.
You're too kind.
Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
No, absolutely. Thank you very, very much for coming. You're
impressive Magic player.
I've got a result or two under my bag.
Too humble. You're an Australian Magic stalwart. You've been around a while. You are almost, and we say this word a lot, you are almost the quintessential Magic player in Australia.
I'm not sure if that's something to be flattered by or something I should be worried about.
But no, yes. Flattery. Yeah. Well, sorry, the quintessential Melbourne player.
Ooh, what does that say? Anyway, yes. No. Thank you very much for having me. My name's Ben. I've been around in the Magic primarily competitive scene for a hot minute now. And yeah, I'm excited to be here to talk to you all.
We're heading into Tarkir Dragonstorm. We are just on the cusp of the next standard legal set. And we've brought you here for your expertise in discerning what makes a card good. There's so much that comes during spoiler season. We see everything from the best of the best to the worst of the worst, and it can all get a bit jumbled up. We can look at these things and go, that looks awesome. This is a giant dragon as we're going into Tarkir. This is going to be awesome. But from a competitive play perspective and from a understanding of what makes a card good, we need a little bit of assistance. Our predictions were not totally off base, but we're definitely not on center in that way. And we want to be well equipped. We want our listeners to be well equipped to understand how to assess cards. What is that skill and what is the knowledge behind understanding what makes a card good? And so we are bringing in an expert.
Yeah, so I guess at its core, it's worth touching on that Magic is a game about information. Right? This is not a real-time strategy game. This is not an actual live physical sport where those games or sports turn into reflex tests and strength and everything else. Like, Magic is very much around decisions at every point. And so to best make those decisions, the tool that you equip yourself with is information. So the training that you do needs to be focused on sourcing that, as well as understanding what information is good, what information is bad, and then using heuristics to accelerate the process. So one of the things with predicting how cards are going to play out is theory and reality are two very different things. And you might look at a card and in the abstract and go, this card's incredibly powerful. But in reality, when you actually get to it, you need to be flexible. We're going to talk through a bunch of cards today, but I wouldn't be surprised if I'm wrong, right? Like, and this is, you know, yeah. I have my reasons for why I think a certain card might be good or might see play, but context can change. And this is, I guess, the first point that I've written down here to talk about is that context of a format is incredibly important. Standard will have that rotating once a year in that 3-year cycle that I'm sure you guys have talked about. At that point, the context is different because it will evolve. But for a set like Dragons of Tarkir mid-cycle, the existing decks are unlikely to be severely shifted from where they are now. So this means that your tier 1 decks are going to stay likely tier 1, your red aggro, your domain, and your bounce decks. And so within the context of evaluating cards, you need to think about, does this card fit within one of those decks? Does this card pair up well against those decks? You then need to look at the second tier down, the kind of the best of the rest sort of stuff. And unfortunately, Otters is not in this list that I've got here.
Yay.
So my estimation, Roots or broadly Golgari Graveyard, Omniscience, Oculus, the mid-range pairings of Golgari and or Dimir, and then the Azorius-based controls, and at a stretch, Convoke. So,
and also
that's two shots so far.
They keep coming, I promise.
I'm sure we can circle back around to the Orzhov build at some point. But yeah, so when you're looking at any card and trying to evaluate any card, you need to think about what these decks, what the tier one decks are doing well at the moment and how it'll line up strategically into those, as well as if the card that you're looking at naturally has a place within one of these kind of tier one or tier two decks. So if you have a phenomenally good card, but it's in the wrong color or trio at this point, we're looking at the wedges, but if it doesn't have a place that would naturally sit with one of these decks, or you know, an easy shift in the mana base for one of these decks to make it happen, unlikely to have a chance, right? Like, new decks are hard to come by the larger the card pool is. And you see this more in the Eternal formats, right? Like, it's very unlikely a new deck is going to break out off one standard set. So that's the important feature. We've got one in here that could do that. I have one card, I think, that, you know, could be spawning its own kind of style of deck. So that is the context. And so the key cards we need to think about now are: this town ain't big enough, nowhere to run, up the beanstalk, Atraxa, Screaming Nemesis, Monstrous Rage. And there's many others in there, and I've just given you a short list to kind of get your brain going. But so some of the features there that we're talking about are efficiency. If you're playing a 4-drop creature which doesn't do anything on ETB and it gets bounced, you have lost so much tempo. Mm-hmm. If you're playing a 4-drop creature that might have an impressive ability but has 3 power and they know where to run it, you're probably down on that speed. So these are the things you need to consider when evaluating any particular card. Keep in mind as well, Tuck here, 3 colors is tough. It's not trivial to put a 3-color expensive card in your deck and expect it to get into play at any reasonable time frame. You're going to be under life pressure early on with red-based aggro decks, or you need to compete with the top end. And Domain has established itself as very efficient at that top end. So you need to be efficient, you need to be castable, and we start to really narrow the card pools down, particularly in a set like Starkey, which is lots of big splashy dragons. Probably eliminate almost all of them from contention right off the bat as being standard or older format competitive cards. With that context in mind, I'm looking for things that are efficient, so you have 1 or 2 mana spells. I'm looking at 4 toughness very keenly, like there's a difference between 3 and 4 matters a lot in the format at the moment. Mana discounts. So one of the cards floating around is Up the Beanstalk. And so if you can cheat a card for less mana but trigger your Up the Beanstalk, you're in a pretty happy place. And then generally graveyard synergistic cards. A few of these decks are graveyard-based decks, and so there's a real potential for some of them to elevate graveyard's strategy from that tier 2 up potentially to that tier 1. Heuristics are really important for this stuff. Shortcutting card evaluations, you know, comparing with cards that do similar things and having that additional context to help support you. So you might compare a card to, say, well, there's one that I'm going to pick on now, Tempest Hawk. So Tempest Hawk, when I first saw this card, I was like, oh, it's Squadron Hawk, but it costs 1 more mana, it's a 2-2 flyer. It wasn't until someone pointed out to me that Tempest Hawk requires a hit on your opponent for this trigger effect to go and find another hawk before I got very, very low on this card. And so initially I was like, oh, Squadron Hawk, that's not powerful. I have a heuristic comparing that to the long term, that was a real deck that back in the day. But then because I have that heuristic and I know that it was fine then, but with all these additional steps and hoops to jump through, not a good card, to be very clear.
And the deck back in the day being the old, very standard dominant Core Blade decks.
Yes.
Yeah, showing my age a little bit. And I guess then stressing that this is the ideation phase, right? So having these conversations, and I touched right on the start about this being about an information economy, talking about these cards. And like the thing is, I didn't pick up the Tempest Hawk, sorry, was on hit on my first pass because I just shortcut it to Squadron Hawk. Talking to people will reveal these things, or talking about how omens work, for example, will reveal how these cards actually work in a functional way. Some people do try to approach the game of Magic as an island, but I advocate for the gathering component and, you know, finding people around you who you can talk to about these things and think about, you know, someone might point out a neat interaction which triggers something for you. And so it's fine to be wrong. It's fine to be like, oh, I'm really excited about this card, and to talk to your friends about it. And then they might be like, oh, but have you thought about this? Or, yeah, but I don't know if that, you know, Dice to Doomblade, right? Like that kind of really base level ideas to help you get there. So I guess, yeah, from my process, I sat down with this. Went through the spoilers as of time of recording to see where I thought potential cards we could talk about were. I found about 21, 22 cards that I thought had something in them from this set. I was a little ruthless to them, and so I know what are the cards I'm going to buy before release, so make sure that I don't have to find them after release. I've got about 7 cards on that list, only 6 for standard. One of them is an Eternal card, but we'll leave that alone for now. And then within that, 4 uncommons, 1 rare, 1 mythic. This is my short list of cards that I have that money where my mouth is, I will be buying these. But there are no real slam dunks amongst this. None of these cards, I'm just like, when the Overlords from Duskmourn were spoiled, I was like, I'm buying all 20 of these. I'm not thinking hard about it. Or similarly, the Verges. Knew they would see play, just bought the playset. And yes, obviously I have a disposable income and I'm very fortunate about that. But that way I knew I wouldn't be chasing them later, and I just got to lock those away. I was very confident that they would see play. Nothing in this set I'm like 100% sold on. There's a couple of cards that I'm like 90% could be very expensive in a few months time because the deck lands, but if it doesn't land, then there'll be dollar cards. So,
and this is definitely still a disclaimer that we are still in the midst, as of time of recording, in the midst of spoiler season. We still have the rest of this week ahead to have some more cards spoiled to us. We haven't had the full set spoiled. So there still could be some things hiding in the corners and the nooks and crannies, hiding in the shadows that we haven't seen yet that are going to come out of, you know, left field and just whack us up across the head, like stock up. I think didn't really see a lot of chatter, didn't see a ton of notice until people realized that getting to see five cards off of a three mana spell to then put two in your hand was a pretty good deal overall.
Yeah, the heuristic there that would have been useful, and admittedly I didn't have this, would have been it's not that far from Dig Through Time.
I think you actually, Maya, called stock up the standard Dig Through Time. I think you said that in a previous episode a while ago because I remember you making the comparison.
Yeah, I think it was last episode. I don't think that episode has come out yet.
Whoops. If it hasn't come out yet, whoops. If it's already come out, then you know.
But it is a good lesson on relying on the times when relying on specific heuristics is not necessarily super useful. Because the heuristic when you see a three mana put two card in your hand spell is divination.
You've written here, we'll just go over this very briefly before we dive into the discussion about these cards that you've picked out for us. There's five key elements that you've pointed out here that we're looking at when we're kind of evaluating cards for whether or not they're going to see play, whether or not it's a good idea, whether this is something that's good for limited but not necessarily good for standard.
Yeah, so, and this is in no particular order. Efficiency, efficiency, efficiency. This is evergreen. If a card is going to cost one mana, then its ability to impact the game is going to matter way more than something like a seven drop, right? A seven drop, if you're ending the game with that seven drop in hand, it was worse than like almost anything else. If a card is efficient, that already gives it a leg up. And a lot of the cards in this set aren't particularly efficient. And that's why I'm a little low on it for its competitive applications. But yeah, efficiency, efficiency, efficiency. Two, context. We've touched on that and I won't go into any more detail, but context is incredibly important. Heuristics let us shortcut these things. And so that's my next point here. And then I guess the one that we haven't really talked about here is pragmatism. It's really easy to see the ceiling on cards, to say in Magical Christmas Land, this card is going to win me the game on the spot. You need to consider all the factors that would lead to the Magical Christmas Land. And then what if everything goes wrong? What's the flaw on this card? And so, you know, if you're talking about this seven drop creature that you're, I'm like, I can cast this on turn two. Like, that's the ceiling. That's the best case scenario. Is that card still good if I miss my third land drop? If my, you know, my opponent playing a deck that doesn't particularly line up for that creature and everything else. And so that pragmatism is really important when to consider the floor, not just the ceiling. And then the last thing is just talk about cards with your friends, with the friendly person running the store. This is, yeah, very much this phase, we're in the ideation phase, talking about how what decks might emerge or could emerge and how this plays in certain archetypes. Until you get to the table and play these cards in your hands for the first time, it's all theory. It's all conversations. And so, yeah, talking about things is really important, which I encourage everyone to do. So,
I always am going to err on the side of talking to people who are better at playing Magic than me. And when they say something is a bad card, it might break my heart, but I have to listen to them at some point because they very likely know much better than me and have far more experience. You pointed out a card to me that when I looked at it and read it, I was like, I don't understand what is so good about this card. And then you said it triggers Beanstalk. And I was like, oh, well, that makes this card so much better than I thought, because I was, you know, blinded by various things. Like, I think the color pips are not lining up properly. I think the overall benefit of this is a little bit hard to understand. But then, oh, it's still a six mana spell that you're casting for three at instant speed that draws you cards. And it was like, I get it now.
We're not actually talking about that card in our selection today. Which is, so that's Rakshasa's Bargain. It was one of the precursors for this episode.
I couldn't believe that you didn't put this in your list. I was so surprised when you sent through these very interesting cards that it was not there, given our previous discussion. But please, what cards should we then be looking at?
I've picked out three here. I wanted to try to cover the basis of some of the concepts we've talked about, which is why Bargain didn't make the cut, because it overlaps a little with some of these things. So I tried to be a little scientific with how we approach this. I'll read out the first one now. So the card that we're starting off with today is called Static Snare. It is a white enchantment for one white pip and four of anything. It has flash, and this spell costs one less to cast for each attacking creature. When this enchantment enters, exile target artifact or creature an opponent controls until this enchantment leaves the battlefield. So it's an O-ring variant, basically.
Let's start with, Kira, efficiency, efficiency, efficiency. Five mana enchantment?
Not, I think most high, I don't think you are ever paying 5 mana for this spell in general. If you are casting this spell, what I would say correctly, you are paying 1 white mana for this spell.
1 white mana is quite low. The context that I immediately think about this card in is against a red or a green-red aggressive slanted strategy. So we're talking, of course, Heartfire Hero, Emberheart Challenger, Manifold Mouse, that style of deck. In my experience, and I will say I do play removal-heavy decks by trade, basically, I cannot really imagine a world where this is consistently being discounted by more than two. This reads to me as a 3-mana enchantment, which feels to me like against aggressive decks, it will be too slow.
What I see in this deck as well is another Leyline Binding. And I think exile effects are still really important in Standard for those creatures like Heartfire Hero, so you can mitigate taking damage, especially on the dies triggers from Heartfire Hero. And the other thing that I'm thinking, this might not be the right way to look at this spell, but I'm also thinking about Leyline rotating this year and about a tool that Domain is losing and something that it could either put in the back pocket or rely on in the future to maintain its status as a tier one deck. This looks similar to Leyline Binding in some ways. It has a discount for a different reason, Leyline Binding being Domain and Static Snare being for attacking creatures. But I almost look and see a Leyline Binding here in some ways. I would agree. I would agree in the way that I don't think you're in Magic Christmas Land, you're paying 1 white. And that would be against your Jeskai Convoke, your maybe mono red prowess lists that have a tendency to dump creatures onto the board and swing with reckless abandon. I think you are more likely to be paying 2 or 3. But overall, I look at this and I see another Leyline Binding. And especially in the Xur shell, it's another 5/5.
Returning back to the context, this obviously does trigger Up the Beanstalk, which is a very, very important determining factor. The other cards that Ben so generously taught us to think about was This Town Ain't Big Enough. So looking at Stasis Snare in the context of Esper Pixie, which is, of course, an aggressively slanted deck, I could see a world where Stasis Snare is used proactively because the number of attacking creatures clause does not care whether it's your creatures or your opponents. So casting this spell in combat when you're attacking with 2 otters and a nurturing pixie and removing your opponent's blocker does feed well into that tempo game plan. And when targeting either a low impact permanent or a token, so when cast in the early game, there is actually a world where returning it to your hand with This Town Ain't Big Enough to deal with a different threat, so essentially trading up your removal, seems like it's a reasonable situation that could occur.
I think you guys have, this is exactly the sort of conversation I was hoping to get out. The one little detail that I've written down that you didn't cover off here is you've identified heuristically the obviously similarities with Leyline Binding. The other heuristic card you can compare this talk to is Witchstalker Frenzy. Now, obviously, different color, which does matter. Witchstalker Friendly getting that discount with attacking creatures and doing 5 damage. This is doing an incredibly similar thing on the attack. Yes, this triggers beans, and yes, this could be played in Domain. I could see something like Convoke being very happy to play this. And then, yeah, Pixie, as you've identified as well, can recur this to retarget more appropriate creatures, as you know your opponent might start by deploying a 2-drop, then a 3-drop, then a 4-drop, if you are re-triggering this to just to continue to keep their best creature off the field. But yeah, Witchstalker Frenzy was the heuristic card that I thought this was most comparative to. If there's a world where 5 damage from Witchstalker Frenzy isn't enough, the Mice version, which is the red aggressive deck with the white, as well as yeah that Convoke shell, could see this as a way to do that. And then if you're talking about really blue sky stuff, if there was a Selesnya tokens style deck playing both beans and this, it would be in Magical Christmas Land.
Well, Convoke was a mechanic that did come into play back in the Tark era of old. So, well, around that era, I suppose. It is possible. It is possible. Although that style of creature go wide and then cast expensive thing, I suppose, is typically a symptom of Eternal formats.
Shall we move on to the next one?
Yes.
Okay. We're starting to get a little bit outside, and so you're going to have to big brain this a little. But next card on the list is Sadisi, Regent of the Mire. It's a black legendary creature with the types of zombie, snake, and warlock. Costs one black and one of anything, so it's a 2 CMC. It has an activated ability, which is tap, sacrifice a creature you control with mana value X other than Sidisi. Return target creature with mana value X plus 1 from your graveyard to the battlefield. Activate only as a sorcery.
The effect that you immediately think of when you see this card is Birthing Pod, which means one of two things. Because Birthing Pod historically, and I get to pull on my, you know, my old man overalls for a bit. Birthing Pod was played in one of two ways. It was either a combo enabler, or it allowed you to go over the top of other decks in a mid-range fashion. And the way it would do this would be with flickering Siege Rhinos with your Restoration Angels, which, be still my beating heart. But I think that's misleading with this card. I don't think that's what this card is doing because it is a reanimate effect, not a tutor effect. The home I can imagine for this is in a Golgari graveyard deck. Something that is very much the like Zevon Faust style of up the beanstalk and then a bunch of, you know, 5 or 6 mana creatures that see reduction effects and then using Sidisi to have that greater top end through a sort of like reanimate style effect. So sacrificing your 6 mana reduction creature to put an Atraxa in play. It's 2 mana, it's cheap. It does have 3 toughness, which in the context of Torch the Tower is a real concession.
And nowhere to run.
Yeah, and nowhere to run for sure. I don't know. I am interested to see where this goes. What do you think, Kira?
Recycling bin. This is going to just recycle your creatures back and forth from graveyard to battlefield. I see something like Insidious Roots really liking this, or Dredger's Insight really liking this, to create those little plant tokens or gain you life off of Dredger's Insight. I see this as a Birthing Pod effect. There's a similar-ish repurposing bay right now with artifacts. Lets you recycle your artifacts up into more and more expensive artifacts. I'm curious about this card. I feel like Green Black Graveyard is going to really like this. I had not considered, you know, the idea of, yeah, I'll just recycle my, you know, Huskburster Swarm into an Atraxa. Oopsie.
That definitely does seem like the top end.
Mm.
But it's worth keeping a pragmatic eye on this because it does have to tap, which means it has to survive a turn. It is, while it is 2 mana, it is efficient. It is a 1/3, which means it's not providing you with any like other value as a creature aside from being, you know, maybe sacrifice fodder in a red-black deck, which is not where I think this card will end up. The other kind of effects I can see being interesting with this would be something like a Karmic Guide effect. Something that is using Sidisi to sacrifice a creature, to bring a creature that also reanimates another creature. This could be a combo enabler through untap effects. I think that is a deck that doesn't currently exist, though.
Two other little things that I would say around this that got me most interested. Pairing with Overlords. So Overlords, you can cast them cheap, and obviously it takes a while for them to tick off, but then you've paid in low investment of 2 or 3 mana to then convert that into a 6, 7, 8 drop, wherever you end up on that curve. Where I'm looking at the efficiency here is what can you convert? And so you're very right to bring up Zevon Faust. That's exactly where my mind started with this, because the black overlords in Zevon Faust plus this fueling your graveyard, and then you play 6 drops. And you don't even necessarily have to go as far as Atraxa, although Atraxa is certainly part of it. But one of the 6 drops, which you theoretically cheat down to 1 mana, use this to sacrifice it into, I think it's Hollow Marauder, the 7 drop, which then has like an ETB trigger that makes your opponent discard a card and you draw a card and everything else. And so even within the context of Zevon Faust's deck untouched, it lets you build up the chain of those cards and lets you kind of accrue this value without going too much further than you already had to. So this is, I think, a very clean card for that deck. The last thing on this list here is keeping in mind that you're looking to abuse this, right? And I'm not necessarily looking at combo applications, but how are we spending less mana and then using that to turn into an Atraxa is one end of the spectrum. The other end of the spectrum is low to cost CMC cards that you can therefore easily turn a 1 or a 2 drop into that have some additional costs that make them hard to cast. And so in this context, that would be Oculus. This can cheat an Oculus into play. Oculus pairs quite well with this because you can continue to put fuel cards into the graveyard. You play the 1/3 that has an adventure where you mill 4 cards and get an instant or
Picklock
sorcery.
Prankster.
Picklock Prankster, thank you. So Picklock Prankster could very easily mill your Oculus, play the Prankster on the second half, sack it, go get that Oculus back. Sidisi's efficiency comes through the fact that it can cheat expensive things or hard to cast things into play. It's also one of the things we haven't really touched on yet and we'll get to in the next card is it's monocolor. A lot of the cards looking at Dragons of Tarkir, you're requiring three colors. You kind of have to work a little hard for them, but the monocolor ones are much easier. And yes, it has got three toughness, can be bounced and everything else, but at two mana, you're not too worried if their investment of mana matches your own. If they're dealing with your two mana card with their two mana card, that's fine.
Equivalent exchange.
All Full Metal Alchemists here. Shall we move on to the next one?
Yes, please.
Okay, so now we're in the really blue sky territory here. This card is, I'll read it and we can talk about it, or you guys can talk about it. It is Teyvahl, Arbiter of Virtue, and I apologize if I'm mispronouncing that. It is a Sultai card, so one blue, one green, one black, and two of anything. It is a legendary creature with the types Spirit and Dragon. It is a 6/6 with flying and lifelink. Spells you cast have Delve. And I'll read the reminder text on that for those who weren't around when Delve was previously such an issue. Each card you exile from your graveyard while casting this spell pays for one colorless mana. The drawback on this card, whenever you cast a spell, you lose life equal to its mana value.
So the comparison here is Omniscience, at least in my mind. This effect is essentially saying you don't have to pay mana, or you have to pay very little mana for your spells. And being a dragon, and again, this is the most blue sky thinking, when you only have to worry about individual mana pips, all of a sudden Mox Jasper gets a lot better. The losing life element of it is a real cost. There isn't an easy way to deal with it in a play this card immediately go off setting. This is obviously very good with Up the Beanstalk.
I'd argue it isn't. I'll let you keep going with that. But
Spicy.
I'm clearly missing cards.
Judge.
Yeah.
Three Steps Ahead is a one mana spell, right?
Three Steps Ahead is a one mana spell.
Even if I pay more mana to activate the spree costs?
Yes.
So I only lose one life? Even if I do every mode of Three Steps Ahead?
Yes.
Seems pretty good to me.
Okay, so research time. Let's...
Like, Rush of Dread?
The one that I've played before that I quite like is a card called Smuggler's Surprise.
Oh my goodness! I love Smuggler's Surprise! In the back of my head, I enjoyed Calamity Combo a lot. I unfortunately was too poor to put the deck together back when it was really running wild, because it was running wild in the local Melbourne RC circuit for a while, and I do think it was your fault.
Yeah, I do that a bit.
But I think it was you that I played the very first time I saw it. And Smuggler Surprise, for those who don't know, is a one mana spell with spree for various other effects, lets you draw two cards, put two creatures onto the battlefield, creatures you control gain hexproof and indestructible until end of turn. It's a bonkers spell, and it was frequently combined with Calamity, Galloping Inferno, and other giant creatures like Terror of the Peaks, Vaultborn Tyrant, to then create copies with Calamity and destroy your opponent in a single turn. I was hoping that with Dragons, we would be getting some yummy things to put in the Smuggler Surprise deck. But I think the interesting thing there is, like, that was typically a green-red deck, and this is no red in sight. This is the black-green-blue deck. I like your thinking here. I like this a lot.
Is there a kicker fireball?
Burst Lightning is a kicker spell. So again, a one-mana spell that you can dump more mana into, but with Teyvahl, you'd only take the one damage from casting the spell.
So the kicker on this is additional costs. So
the kicker is...
Badum-tish.
Kill me now. As Ben was saying, this is five mana. It is across three colors. It does reward you with a reasonably good body. It is a 6/6 flying lifelink, so you do have to have hard removal to deal with it. Unfortunately, hard removal is typically less than five mana these days. Of course, we're talking Leyland Binding, Get Lost.
Go for the throat.
I mean, this town ain't big enough. Not even hard removal, right? Like, can you tap out five mana, cast this, bounce it? Joy.
It seems like it has less of a payoff to me than something like Azorius Abuelos. Maybe it exists as a function of the metagame shifting because of other cards in Tarkir that we're not aware of. Some sort of, yeah, some very large mid-range deck in Sultai or in black-green colors to cheat this out. I'm interested to see what Ben has to say about this card. I think this card would be a lot better if it itself had Delve, as all cards would be.
This card also would be so much better if it was one fewer color. If it was not Sultai, which obviously, of course, in the context of Tarkir with the wedges and everything, and this being the Sultai spirit dragon with the lore and all of that, makes sense. But it would be better from a functional card standpoint if it was not one of those colors. Because then it would much easier, because it feels like this card is missing a color that it pairs well into for some reason. Like talking about this Calamity combo, it's missing red. Talking about, you know, Omniscience Abuelos, it's missing white. It feels like it is slightly awkwardly in between other colors that it might pair well into, given the archetypes that we're talking about.
And importantly, this is not an Omniscience effect. It is limited by the number of cards in your graveyard. We're not in Modern at the moment, so getting to 7 on turn 2 is actually quite tricky. I would be interested to see where this finds a home, if at all. I won't lie, I did see these cards in the spoilers, not considering today, and I dismissed it as a commander card.
All really good points. First, to the comment around Up the Beanstalk. Up the Beanstalk naturally wants you to pair with things like Leyline Binding. Spending 2 mana on Leyline Binding is very reasonable, very efficient, triggers you Up the Beanstalk. The problem is if you pay 2 mana with a Tyvale in play, you're still taking 6 damage. And so it kind of doesn't want to be in the Up the Beanstalk deck, because the Up the Beanstalk deck wants to play a bunch of cheap cards that trigger it. You know, the Rakshasa's Bargains, Up the Beanstalk, the Impending Overlords. So it almost is the antithesis on that. It wants you to find expensive cards that you can cheat into play somehow that you wouldn't be able to normally. And so, not that this necessarily pairs well, but there's the 8 mana Wrath in Sultai now, or whatever it is. It's one of the, I can't remember its name.
Oh,
it's one of the ones.
Yes, I know what you're talking about.
Paying 3 mana for that Wrath, even if you're killing your own Tyvale, like, that's powerful. So this is a kind of a blue sky. Can there be an archetype that abuses this particular ability to reduce mana costs? Historically, one of the most powerful things you can do is trade resources for mana. And so Delve, which is why things like Dig Through Time and Treasure Cruise were very powerful in their heyday. And
even
Gurmag Angler. Gurmag Angler is still seeing play in 7-point Highlander, which allows vintage cards, to be clear. Phyrexian mana, typically very powerful, right? Trading your life to do it. So this sits in that realm of, if there is a good way to abuse this, then it will do phenomenally well in its ability to play some very powerful spells very quickly. The drawback is very large here. And so one of the things I did talk about was, you know, talking the ceiling on this is very high, but the floor in it, where's the floor on this? And so what I don't have a good sense of is, how bad is the floor here? Now, it could be that it is incredibly bad and that putting a 5 mana do nothing card in your deck is too much of a cost. But this style card I see as strong enough on its surface that it could create a new archetype. There could be a new deck off the back of this, a Sultai-based, likely control or control-adjacent deck. And then, yeah, I think, Kira, as you mentioned, the thing that most excites me about this is the interaction with the Spree cards. Rush of Dread, for example, 3 mana for effectively 8 mana worth of cards using Rush of Dread. That's a big game. So there's a few cards that this synergizes well with that haven't necessarily had the chance to shine in the spotlight of Modern or older formats as well, that this could be a piece. Now, the reason I stress this is not financial advice is this is highly speculative, and this is the sort of card where talking about it is more important than anything else. I wanted to, when I was picking out the 3 cards, I didn't want just to be like this one's efficient, this one's efficient, this one's efficient, because that's not interesting. This is very much a card, and cards like this, you know, the big splashy cards that might be commander bait or they might have a place, talk to people about them. Read forums on the internet, as much as I would not necessarily encourage people to go to Reddit. People on Reddit will have random ideas that you might not have thought of. They'll have thought about rules interactions. There's Tygam does very interesting things with Impending. So if you want to Google that later, listeners at home, there's an interesting interaction for you to go and find out about. But this could be an archetype creator. This style card has the potential, because of that cost reduction, because of a very historically powerful thing, and that's the heuristic I'm using here, to break open a different archetype that doesn't currently exist. Whereas these other two I see as fitting into existing archetypes or supplementing them or slightly tweaking the colour base, whatever it is, this is one that I would doesn't fit into any of the decks.
It's worth noting again that the reliance on heuristics isn't necessarily perfect. Because when I looked at this card, I thought of Omniscience, which means I inherently discounted cards with additional costs. Because the interaction with things that allow you to cast a card without paying its mana cost does not let you account for additional costs. Things like Spree, things like Kicker, things like X spells. Importantly, Tyveld does, which opens up a lot of design space that cards like Omniscience otherwise wouldn't. And that's really, really interesting.
I think these are really interesting choices, and I think you've created a lot of really interesting conversation and also gotten us to look at cards in a way we wouldn't normally have looked at them. I know I have a tendency to look at a card and go, that's awesome, Magical Christmas Land. This is the best thing I've ever seen. Haunt the Network, there's no better use of 5 mana. And then I have someone who's better at the game, who's played more than I have, go, is that really what you want to be doing for 5 mana when your opponent could Sunfall? And you go, that's a really good point, actually. So thank you so much for joining us and for bringing these cards to us and creating, I think, some of those interesting conversation I've had around speculative cards all year.
Thank you for having me. Yeah, I didn't want to just put 3 cards down, which were all kind of the same framework style thing, which is why we went a little bit off the deep end at the end there. But
learning how to think critically about cards is a skill that you develop, and it's something that comes from playing a lot of Magic, testing a lot, and speaking to other people. That's not something that you really just pick up on your own. Looking at cards, you could look at every single card at the set and have your own thoughts about it, but there's going to be someone who points out to you, you know that if you cast a card for Spree, you're still only taking damage equal to the mana value, not the mana that you spent, and you go, oh my gosh, that's brilliant. I hadn't thought of that. And so again, thank you for helping us flex our Magic muscles and for, in some ways, equipping us with the skills to develop a new skill. Well, look, I think that just about wraps up our discussion on Tarkir and about spoilers. Keep an eye out across social media on Twitter, Blue Sky, on the Wizards page on Scryfall for Tarkir spoilers. We're still, as of this recording, still in the midst of spoiler season. By the time this episode comes out next week, there is a chance that we'll be fully spoiled and there'll be so much that we missed and there'll be so much that we're even more excited about. But that's for another episode. So thank you so much for joining us today. I cannot wait to play against you in another RC and have my ass absolutely handed to me yet again. Where can we keep track of you and the team's progress across social media?
I'd be remiss to not thank our sponsor in this window, so thank you for letting me do that. Pat from Josh and Pat's MTG Bazaar, which you can find on Facebook and soon to be a website as well. But yeah, if you jump on the Facebook there, they auction and they sell singles. Pat sponsors Team Bus Stop and we're very grateful to him. He supports us in a lot of ways and he's a good company as well, which certainly helps.
Fly, Eagles, fly!
And yes, that's a reference to Pat's football team.
I see.
Pat's a Philadelphia Eagles fan.
Yes.
Right.
And then, yeah, so me personally, you can find me on Blue Sky at Ben Tudman, which is just my name. I'm sure it'll be in the show notes.
it is phonetic,
so it's fine. Or I also run my team's social medias as well, so you can busstop-mtg. With all that said, that is all that we have for you today. We look forward to seeing you again next week. New episodes released on Mondays at 11 a.m. Australian Eastern Standard Time. Until then, you can keep track of all of our releases at RaiseMTG on both Instagram and Blue Sky. You can find Kira on the Slam.
Don't worry. We sometimes have to do these like 2 or 3 times.
Where was I? Okay, yeah. Until then, you can keep track of all our releases at RaiseMTG on both Instagram and Blue Sky. You can find Kira on the same platforms, kirabobira.jpg. And Maya at Maya MTG. Big thank you to the State Library Victoria for the ongoing use of their space. And until next week, remember, as you act, so shall you be judged.